Hello, this is Leighton Pierce presenting Radio Sampha, brought to you by the Department of Environment, Water and Natural Resources. If you would like to make a suggestion on future speakers, provide some feedback, please leave a message on either our Facebook, Twitter or our text line 0427 688028.
This is Leighton Pierce from Radio Sampha, and today we're talking with Dr. Peter Patsalis and talking about resistance testing. Peter, welcome to the show.
Good afternoon.
Yeah, Peter, what I guess the growers want to know is why do we do resistance testing?
Oh, look, it's very important to create a baseline of where you are with herbicide efficacy. Spraying a herbicide and not knowing if it's going to work because of resistance is a huge risk. There's so many things that can go wrong when spraying herbicides, such as water rates and other non-resistance issues. But if you've got resistance in the equation as well, it means that you can get pretty big herbicide failures. So yeah, if you can get the weed, hit them right, get them out of the way, then that's the way to move forward. And really, the only way to know is to do a resistance test.
What's the best timing in a year to do resistance testing, and how do growers go about doing an actual test?
Right, there's two tests, and each test is as effective as the other one. One is the quick test, and that's working right now, and that is where weeds are growing in the paddock. This can be either before sowing a crop or after sowing a crop, and the weeds are collected, sent to me, and we do a simple resistance test. The way we do a test is we will trim the plants up, wait for them to regrow for a week. So an old plant becomes a young plant again because you've got young, actively growing leaves. And then we spray them just like you spray them in the paddock. And within 3 or 4 weeks, we have an answer. So from the day we receive it to the day you get the report is 4 weeks. So, yeah, that's a lot of power to have with that kind of information.
So how many chemicals are you running over these weeds?
Oh, I leave that up to the farmers. They can choose. Some farmers want to know, I sprayed glyphosate, the ryegrass has survived. Is it resistant to glyphosate? And they want to test one herbicide. Usually about 4 or 5 are the common ones. Some farmers may test glyphosate, but they want to know, 1,500 mils, will that kill the ryegrass? Yes or no? If I increase the rate, will that work? And so some farmers will actually choose 2 or 3 rates of glyphosate to try and see if higher rates work. And sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't. So it's good information to have.
So what are you finding around the state with all the results that you're collating at the moment? Is resistance building? Are there some hot spots that we should be looking out for?
Yeah, where we are at the moment with resistance testing, it's the beginning of the quick test. So what I've received so far have been samples where there's suspicion of glyphosate resistance in ryegrass. And in some cases, yes, they are resistant, but in other cases, the plants are not resistant.
So how big is the resistance issue in South Australia?
It's quite big in certain areas. So we know this from random weed surveying that we've been doing through Adelaide University. And the basic patterns are that wherever ryegrass is grown, Group B softener urea type herbicides don't work. But when you start looking at Group A herbicides in the mid-north of South Australia, the southeast and the lower Eyre Peninsula, they're the higher rainfall areas, Group A's are not really working, particularly the ones that are selective in cereals. The ones used in canola are still quite effective with respect to what we're finding in the surveys. When you go to the more remote areas, such as the northern part of the SA Mallee or the northern Eyre Peninsula, then in these areas, we're finding that even Group A herbicides that are used in cereals, like even hoegrass, is working in the majority of cases. So there's huge benefit, you know, huge potential to use herbicides that have been developed 30 years ago, are excellent herbicides for controlling susceptible ryegrass. And many farmers are missing out because they're assuming that they've got a lot of resistance and missing out on these really effective herbicides. That's ryegrass. When we look at bromegrass, Group A herbicides are still working very effectively, and it's very difficult to detect Group A resistance in brome in a random approach in any part of South Australia. But when it comes to Group B herbicides, and they're things like Atlantis, Crusader, Monza, your cereal selective herbicides, then yeah, we're starting to see some significant levels of resistance in brome through these herbicides. But when you look at the imidazolinone herbicides, so they're the IMI herbicides, herbicides such as Intervix, they're still working very effectively, and to date we've only found one population in South Australia that's resistant to Intervix.
So looking into the future, what sort of new chemistry have we got becoming available, I guess, Peter, in the future?
Yeah, there's some really good pre-emergent herbicides that will be available starting from next year right through to about 2020. There's some new chemistry, and some of these are actually new modes of action. So they're effective, selective in cereals, some are selective in canola, and they control all sorts of resistant ryegrass. You know, multiple resistant ryegrass is not an issue. These herbicides do control it. So good news on that front. Where we're having, you know, a problem is trying to find herbicides to control barley grass and brome in cereals. That's where, you know, we have a hurdle. Even if we find effective pre-emergent herbicides, because these two species germinate much later in the season, you know, you get the first cohort, the first flush of the weeds, but things germinating later in the season, well, you can't control them with pre-em. So, you know, that's the problem. So we really are searching to identify a post-emergent herbicide that we can use in cereals to control barley grass and brome, and, you know, hopefully even ryegrass.
So where does a farmer go for more information about resistant testing?
Okay, everything is on the web these days, and so am I. So websites, plantscienceconsulting.com.au. There's a lot of information there. Or, as you know, farmers that like to talk to people, they can call me on 0400 66 4460.
Excellent. Thank you very much for joining us today, Peter, and we look forward to talking to you again in the future.
Yep, it's been a pleasure.
Follow SANFA on social media for Radio SANFA updates and to provide feedback on Radio SANFA.
Welcome to Radio SANFA. You're listening to Leighton Pearce, and today we have Pete Treloar from the York Peninsula. Pete, you've been conducting nitrogen testing throughout the growing season, and a number of your clients' paddocks are comparing long-term no-till paddocks to short-term no-till paddocks in respect to nitrogen levels. What are the results that you've seen so far?
So basically, we've been monitoring the paired paddock situation for, we're going into our third year now, but it all came about because screwing off precision aid work, doing variable rate nitrogen and nitrogen trials, we were really struggling to get a response to increase nitrogen. I could see a response to variable rate nitrogen, like saving money on my poorer ground, but I could never get the better ground to respond to higher rates. This led to doing some soil testing, and we're just seeing really high levels of soil nitrogen, and all the dominantly we're in talking long-term no-till paddocks, like farmers that have been no-tilling for at least 10 years, probably 15 now. So that led to comparing it to a more traditional farming system, fortunately, that a farmer had taken over starting share farming the neighbouring lot. Started doing monthly testing, and what we saw the first year was a wheat crop on a lentil stubble, on a legume stubble, and generally the winter mineralisation between the two systems was identical. We saw big peaks in June, July, August, when it was a wetter month. But then when we looked at across the year, compared the two systems, we saw that autumn and spring, the long-term no-till had a lot more nitrogen in the system when the soil was warmer. And the year we happened to do this was one of our dry spring years. And yet we still saw that jump in mineralisation in the long-term no-till. You know, we thought that was pretty interesting. Secured some funding to do it again for another season, and this year was wheat on wheat. The two fish, both paddocks, fortunately, were going into wheat again. And this time, the short-term no-till didn't have any winter mineralisation at all, or any real serious spike. And it's kind of what you'd expect. With history of farming taught us that cereal on cereal, not getting much mineralisation to need nitrogen. But what we noticed, in the long-term no-till, again, we saw the huge spike in nitrogen. And so there was up to 100 kilos extra nitrogen in 80 centimetres of soil compared through winter again. So we've continued this again into our third season. So fingers crossed, it's actually going into canola and barley this year, but we'll still see the effect of dealing with last year's stubble, not this year's crop. So it'll be interesting to see how the two systems compare.
So where's this extra nitrogen coming from, Pete?
Just from the huge increase we've got in biomass and organic matter and microbes, and everything we're told when we start no-tilling is looking after our soils. Your soils will get better. And talk to any no-till farmer when they first started, and they'll talk about the fact they don't keep water lying out in their paddocks as much anymore. Like, it infiltrates easier, and they gradually they'll see a change in their soil structure, or there's things they notice, observe, but in the long term, it just continually adds up. As you're applying each year, retaining stubbles and not beating the crap out of our soil, so you're only, doesn't matter if it's a knife point or disc, we're only minimal disturbance, We're only doing it once, so you're not knocking anything around. Each year, you're improving your system. And then through crop rotation, you're mixing up what you're adding to it. So one year, you're putting canola in. It's a completely different stubble than a cereals, a wheat stubble. And then you might have lentils, and so you're putting a legume in there, or beans, or something. So just over the journey of no-till, like we're continually seeing our soils improve, personally, I don't think we've adapted to the fact we have improved our soil health. And we're still operating under assumptions that we used to run with nitrogen from the early no-till days.
So I guess this means that growers will be able to add a lot less nitrogen to their crops at seeding.
We're still seeing a response to nitrogen, but not the rate. So the actual, so I term it that the timing of the application is more important than the amount. Early nitrogen is more important than late. Just because we've got huge levels of nitrogen in the soil doesn't mean a growing crop has still got its tiny little root system. It's not exploring the soils like a crop is in spring. So yeah, I'm more inclined to think we'll be leaning towards putting more nitrogen early and less later. And I've got a couple of clients that, and it all depends on scale, but a couple of smaller farmers that are quite comfortable. They've, instead of putting out two lots of nitrogen, they've gone to three. So three lots of 50 kilos rather than two lots of 80 or one lot of 150.
So we've got a lot of farmers probably entering their 15 to 20 years of no-till throughout the state. What do you deem long-term? Are we starting to see these responses within 5 years? Are we 10 years where we're seeing them?
The short answer is we don't know, and the long answer is we're not real sure. Yeah, I just really encourage farmers, as yield monitors are a very common thing now, just put a trial strip in your paddock. It costs you absolutely nothing, but might make you a lot of money in the future as you get a better understanding of how much nitrogen you need. Simple as just, right, I might skip a strip, might not put nitrogen on this application, or you might double it, or halve it, or just do something, and just remember which run it is in the paddock, tie a rag to a post, or chuck an old chemical drum out there or something, so you can remember where it is. And then just see what impact it has on your yield monitor at the end of the year. It's as simple as that.
Excellent, Peter. Now, obviously with your report, is there any way that growers can get hold of your reports? I know that we've been putting up images on our Facebook page, et cetera, and through Twitter.
Yeah, so at this stage, it goes out in the Alkaline Soils newsletter, so it's all been part of the YP Alkaline Soils group work.
Excellent. Well, I'd like to thank you on behalf of Radio Sanford for making time. This is one of the inaugural first phone calls that we've done, recordings. So thanks very much, Pete.
No worries at all, mate.
If you subscribe to Radio Sanford through iTunes, don't forget to provide a rating and a review on the iTunes website for Radio Sanford.
Welcome to Radio Sanford. I'm Leighton Pearce, and today we're interviewing Peter Heyman from SARDI in the climate section. Welcome to Radio Sanford, Peter.
Thanks, Leighton.
Obviously, one of the biggest issues with climate at the moment is it's a big risk to farmers. And yeah, what are the risks that are apparent to farmers with making climate decisions with their crop?
Farmers have always been dealing with year-to-year variability in climate. And that's always been the case. In more recent times, more understanding of what drives some of that, drives some of the variability. So why we get wetter years and drier years, and for that matter, why we get wetter decades and drier decades, or longer periods. So there's a lot of work trying to understand some of those climate drivers, and then the big challenge of how do those, that understanding get incorporated into prediction. So it's one thing to understand, to say why a season was dry. It's another thing to say what the coming season will be. And that's just an active area of work. And I guess my feeling is in agriculture, we need to be smart in working out how we can use that.
So you're talking about predictions and probabilities. So the $64 million question is, what is the prediction and probabilities of a good season for 2016?
So what do I use? I'm using the Bureau's regular forecasts, which are based on their dynamic model, PoAMA, and moving to their new model, AccessS, which is going to give us information. And I also, in that sense, look at when those forecasts are more skillful, when they're much better than guessing. As we move into spring, when you just look on the website for the Bureau, you'll see that the forecasts tend to be better for spring. And so that's the period where there's more confidence in that. And the other aspect is we do know that a big driver across areas of South Australia is what's happening with El Niño, La Niña. Now, that obviously has interactions with the Indian Ocean dipole and other aspects of the time. But there's a lot of work into sort of predicting El Niño, La Niña, what that means. Last year was an El Niño year that was well forecast from early on. So the other thing that I look at is the Bureau of Meteorology's ENSO tracker, where they actually use something a little bit like a bushfire alert, where you move from a neutral to a watch to an alert to a declaration. So at the moment, that's moved to a La Niña, which is tends to be wetter springs, it's moved to a La Niña watch. Now, it's very, very interesting to see how that's going to change over the next few months.
Okay, so what sort of duration is a farmer waiting for as that probability increases of a potential La Niña?
The information gets better as you go onwards. And so Graham Anderson from Victoria has a nice analogy. He says Richmond footy fans are very, very confident about what's going to happen around February, March, April. But the notion of how Richmond's going to fare, they have much better information in July. And as he points out, it's similar with what's happening with El Niño. There's a lot of talk, a lot of confidence about what might happen early on. But as we move towards the July, August period, there's a lot more confidence there. This information tends to be more reliable for top dressing decisions than for crop choice.
You talk about top dressing, and what were the results of top dressing last year based on the climate information that was coming through?
So last year was an interesting one. For some people, the talk of El Niño, for some people sort of said, well, let's pull back too much. So there may have been an element of not really looking at the fact that El Niño doesn't mean drought. El Niño means an increased risk of drought. And this is difficult to use that. We did a study where we used Poama for heart and looked at top dressing at heart and just sort of asked a question. We took the 30 years from 1980 to 2010 and we just said, okay, if you just used Poama in the winter period for spring and said, is that telling me above average spring or below average spring? And then we'd change the top dressing and ran our Apsin cropping model, which yield prop is based on, to just explore that question. Now, the first thing is that the model is right in terms of above, below, median rainfall. Twice as often it was wrong. So in those 30 years, 19 times, you got the right guidance, and 11 times, you got the wrong guidance. So it was saying better, it's going to be more than average and it's less than average. That's the odds. So that's right twice as often as it's wrong. Now, for some people, they'll say, go back and come back till it's 90% right. My view is that it's a long wait. You'll be a long wait before you get weather-type accuracy from climate. What we're going to have to work with is something that's giving us the odds of 50-50 to 60-40, 66-33. Is that something that's useful? Now, in that situation in heart, under those assumptions that we put in there, it was worth about $10 a hectare. That's not huge, but that's probably, I mean, that sort of amount, I think it's a believable amount, $4 to $5 to $10 a hectare, and that's about often what wheat breeding gives you.
So you've obviously, as a climatologist, got a lot of tools that you can access, Poama and Apsin, etc. Just from a farmer's point of view, what are the tools that they should be using to make these decisions for wet spring and top dressing?
For some people, yield profit is a really good tool that brings together a lot of the Apsin modelling in that situation. And some people use that directly or use some of the output from that. And I think that's a useful tool. Then people have all sorts of their own little budgeting exercises and so on. And I guess the challenge is to, I would say that the ENSO tracker is worth looking at because it actually gives the reasoning of where things are going. Dale Gray from the Victoria puts out that fast break and gives sort of information on where things are going. And the Bureau has their forecast. We use that for the information. I think it's a really important area we need to do more work on is how do we use that in decision-making well? We have some projects where we're trying to do that a bit better, is to really say, okay, how do we use that shift in probabilities to make a decision? And I accept that's a difficult challenge. What would be nice is to say, oh, well, it's going to be a wet finish, and so we just know we're going to do that. What we should be saying is that the chance of a dry finish is reducing a bit, and the chance of a wet finish is increasing. And so the odds, if you like, without any change in what's happening in the Pacific Ocean or anything else, would say there's an equal chance of being in the bottom third of years or the top third of years, the drier finish or the better finish. What we're saying here is that the drier finish is reducing, but by no means eliminated. And that's a really, really important point. So we have to then just sort of, it's a saying I've got to use the forecast to know which way to lean, not jump. And obviously it'd be nice to have the confidence to say exactly what's going to happen. We don't. What we need to do is to say, okay, here's sound risk management. We've got that running. Some people might say, my risk management is pretty robust. I'm not going to use the forecast here. Other people might say, okay, on these paddocks, I'm going to just up it my option a little bit. And I think that's the sort of way that you people are sensibly playing this game, but never doing it in a way that they're betting the whole farm on it, because demonstrably the skill of the forecast isn't good enough to do that.
Have you got any suggestions? Obviously, extreme heat days in, say, September, October have been an issue in the past, and frosts throughout the period.
One thing you can see, not surprisingly in a way, if you think about it, that El Niño events tend to be giving us more heat and also more frost events. So the hotter conditions and that dry everywhere, there's just the land heats up, there's less moisture to cool things down, and we basically, when we get heat events, they tend to be a bit worse in that situation. When we get the weather system to give us those northerlies, they tend to be a bit drier and hotter under El Niño conditions. The other aspect about El Niño conditions is that we have clear night, less cloud cover, and our frosts are radiation frost. We tend to get more damaged. What we're saying this year, the Bureau's on a La Niña watch. To an extent, that decreases the risk a little bit. But unfortunately, these very late frosts in late September, October are rare events with very bad consequences. So there's maybe some ability to predict the increased likelihood or decreased likelihood of them. But again, there's weather events, and you just need that high pressure system and the inflow of cold air, and bang, we have these frosts. And so unfortunately, they remain these tails of the distribution that come along and can be very damaging and are very, very difficult to forecast in a seasonal scale. Obviously, the short-term weather forecasts of frosts are quite good, and that's something that grape growers and people with wind machines can use, but obviously cereal farmers are not in that situation. However, I think an interesting aspect about the GODC National Frost Initiative and so on is this importance of being able to respond after a frost event. And so sometimes these forecasts are useful to help in sort of being alert to the fact that a frost may be there, and then responding to make decisions, to also work out which parts of the farm are more frosted and more frosty, and then use that for decision making into the future.
In terms of climate variability, it's been a big issue over the last few years that the temperature is rising, rainfall is falling, getting more extreme events. What's the latest science showing for South Australia in terms of climate variability, in terms of temperature and rainfall?
Clearly, temperature is rising. So we have year-to-year variability. So in El Niño year, things will tend to be a bit warmer, and in La Niña, a bit cooler. But overall, there's clear evidence about the temperatures rising, and the most straightforward explanation for that is the fact that we're changing the radiated properties of the atmosphere from the rising CO2 and other greenhouse gases. So what we are seeing, and this is an interesting aspect, is that our crops will develop quicker. One of the concerning features is that we're not seeing spring frosts reduce as fast as, say, spring hot days are increasing. And so even if you just leave the spring frost risk of where it is, although there is some evidence in some cases it's actually increasing, the fact that wheat's growing faster is putting us into slightly higher frost risk. Put on top of that the fact that we're early sowing, dry sowing, and often in many cases using slightly quicker cultivars of wheat, you throw on top some of these warmer periods that, and these crops are just growing. Most people are aware plants measure time by temperature, so they're not measuring it by how many days. And some of the cultivars we're using are particularly sensitive to just moving by temperature. And so as you get warmer conditions, they're counting that as they'll move into more sensitive stages quicker. The rainfall story is just inherently more difficult because there's just so much variability in rainfall. In South Australia, as the Bureau, Darren Reynolds will point out, that in southern part of South Australia, I mean in the Mount Gambier and the southeast, there's a very, very worrying drying trend there. Other areas, it bouncing around. I mean, so I guess the complexity there is that when we say we're not really sure what the near future, the coming decades will be with rainfall, That doesn't mean it won't change. It just means that exact extent of change is less clear. It is worrying that there is a consensus amongst climate models. This is very strong consensus about warming, but there's also a worrying consensus on drying over the longer term. But the extent of that drying in the models ranges a fair bit. Farmers are working, and agronomists are working really hard at improving the water use efficiency of their farming systems, and that's a smart thing to do in any situation. So capturing the summer rainfall, controlling weeds, timely sowing, and all these aspects are ways that people are able to produce, in many cases, surprisingly good crops on relatively poor rainfall.
On behalf of Radio Sanford, I'd like to thank you for your time, and we'll hear from you sometime down the track, I imagine, and check in maybe later in the year just to see if everything eventuated that we hoped.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Radio Sanford, the voice of agriculture.